Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the advantages of taking a long view on women's health so that we understand the functioning of bodies not simply over one lifetime, but over thousands of generations? Every living human is the product of thousands of years of biological refinement by the processes of natural selection. And as my guest today can explain, a knowledge of how our bodies developed before the rise of modern society can help us to understand the best ways to keep them healthy under very different conditions than our ancestors inhabited. Wenda Trevathan is Professor Emerita of Anthropology at New Mexico State University and author of the 2010 book Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. She's in town to deliver the annual Ben and Trudy Termini, Distinguished Anthropologist Lecture at UT Arlington this evening. Wenda, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's nice to be here.
So what is evolutionary medicine and how does it sort of fit into the broader attempt to understand the way our bodies work?
Well, the definition is applying principles of evolution to medical research and practice, which is a kind of dry definition, but I'd like to maybe give a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think that most of us are familiar with is the problem of antibiotic resistance. A lot of diseases evolve resistance to the arms that we develop to try to fight them. It's very much like an arms race, in fact. A lot of times arms race is used as a metaphor for what happens. So in 1941, or I think that was about when penicillin was invented, most of the things like staphylococcus infections were resistant to penicillin. But as that was used more and more, then the staphylococcus organism became more and more resistant to penicillin, so that pretty soon penicillin didn't work on staphylococcus. So we developed something more powerful. They came back, if you can imagine, arms race. We start off with the slingshots. They come back with guns or with knives, guns, and pretty soon we've got mutually assured destruction. And essentially, we have a number of organisms today that we don't have anything in the arsenal to fight. So it's a little bit scary when you think about that. So that is a situation where understanding something about how that process works, how that evolutionary process works, could make a difference between life and death. And the thing that's so important, I think, about trying to understand how the evolutionary process works in that case is that it doesn't necessarily have to go in the direction of more powerful, more virulent organisms. It can actually go the other way. And an example of that that I often use in discussing this is that we had a fairly powerful predator in the wolf, which is still a wonderful part of our landscape in a few places, but that was not an animal that we wanted to necessarily coexist with. But through thousands of years, the ancestors of wolf have evolved into the modern dog, which in most cases is to some extent a fairly comfortable animal to be around. So we have taken, in the metaphorical sense at least, a very powerful, say dangerous predator, and through time it has evolved into a passive animal that we can coexist with in many cases. We could do the same thing with these diseases. It is possible to turn that process around. Instead of the arms race toward greater and greater virulence, we could turn that around to essentially a peaceful coexistence with some of the organisms that are now dangerous. So that's an example where evolutionary medicine may have life or death consequences.
I was really fascinated by something I hadn't given much thought to before I read this book, which is that what we consider to be the normal function of a woman's body, studied in wealthy countries, mostly in the West, may not actually reflect what is normal as much as much more difficult conditions might be closer to what humans have experienced for thousands of years.
That's a very important point, and that's really why I wrote this book, because I think if you look at medical textbooks, at least the ones I looked at when I was writing the book, and if you look at people's understanding of what is normal, we can have an idea that normal puberty occurs at this time, normal age of first birth is this. And when I talk about normal, I really am referring more to the idea of a norm and not in contrast to abnormal.
Right.
Because we do recognize there's quite a range of variation and it varies by population and so on. But it strikes me that most of what we understand through medical research and women ourselves about what is the norm is actually very, very modern. It's probably less than 100 years old. And it's based on studies of women like you and me who are relatively healthy. We have not experienced pathogens all of our lives that we've had to fight off in terms of infectious diseases or parasites and so on. And we don't, despite the fact that some of us may be trying real hard to exercise daily, we're not doing it in the way that our ancestors did or in the way that many women in most parts of the world do today. So my argument in the book is that our idea of what is the norm for women's health is based on a very unusual population, that is modern, industrialized women from industrialized nations who really are, to use a phrase I occasionally talk about in the book, who are overfed, under-exercised in the sense of how much physical activity we experience, and under-infected. Because a lot of the energy the sort of metabolic resources that women have had throughout, or people have had throughout most of human history, have to go toward not only maintaining the body functioning, but also maintaining a good state of health in the face of a lot of infectious organisms, in the face of parasites and things like that that we're not dealing with today. So the idea of what is normal in women's health is actually unusual in terms of time because it's a modern kind of thing. And it's also unusual if you look at women throughout the world, in many parts of the world. And the dangers of that, perhaps that's an extreme phrase, but at least some of the problems that come from that, are that if you develop drugs and medications, particularly those that are related to reproduction, based on that understanding of modern women as the norm, then there'll be problems when those drugs or those birth control pills, for example, are used by women in other parts of the world, by women in modernizing societies who are becoming more modern in terms of the kinds of foods that are available to them and kinds of activity levels and so on. So there is a risk of using that understanding of normal in medical research and development of drugs.
So what do we learn by looking at lower primates about the course of our evolution and the way our bodies work? And what are the limits to that kind of research?
Well, there are huge limits. Obviously, we're very, very different organisms and we have very different experiences. And our evolutionary history is very different. When it comes to trying to understand something about past reproductive events, the fossil record is not terribly informative. Hormone levels don't preserve in the fossil record. There aren't very many things that we can rely on. So traditionally, when we're trying to, if we can imagine asking the question, what were women's lives like thousands of years ago? If you rely on the fossil record, you're not going to get very far with that, except maybe understanding something about size. And in the case of my research on childbirth, you can get some information about the pelvis and so on. But we traditionally rely on a little bit of work on non-human primates because there certainly are some biological overlaps there. Chimpanzees are our closest relatives and bonobos, so we try to understand something about what may be happening to them. For example, how do wild chimpanzees and captive chimpanzees differ in their reproductive physiology in this instance? Because captive chimpanzees are sort of living like modern humans. The other source of information, which certainly has its pitfalls, but it's looking at people who, at least until recently, lived lives that we think were similar to the lives of our ancestors. Now, a lot of people think that when I talk about hunting and gathering populations, that those are our ancestors. Well, of course, they're not. They are modern descendant people just like we are. But if you look at their lifestyles, we conjecture, and that's about as far as I can say because we can't prove anything like this, but we conjecture that their lifestyles are more similar to those of our ancestors than our lifestyles are. And there's reasonable evidence for that. And so we collect data, and it's actually fairly easy to collect data on reproductive events if you do what anthropologists do and hang out with some of these people for a long period of time. And we can actually measure how much energy they expend on a daily basis in terms of gathering foods, moving about the landscape, and so on. We can quantify the kinds of nutritional intake in the foods that they're eating. And we can actually collect information on hormones. There are some very interesting techniques that have been developed where you can assay certain hormones through saliva, which is usually fairly easy to obtain from people. Or from blood spots, even just a prick of the finger, you can get a little bit of blood and be able to assay a number of hormones. So we can actually look at some of these people. We recognize that they are not our ancestors, but we consider them a pretty good proxy for what our ancestors were like. And then we make comparisons between what we find in those studies of those people and what we find in Boston or Dallas.
So one interesting thing that has been discovered is we know that women's hormones sort of shift throughout the course of a monthly cycle. Conditions like PMS are things that sort of in the West really make us crazy. But it may be that the signals our bodies give us and in preparing for either conceiving or not conceiving a child in any given month have a lot to do with the sort of fitness of the environment around us. Is that right?
I don't think there's any doubt about that. And if you can think about it over the lifespan, throughout most of well, we believe at least throughout most of evolutionary history, there have been sufficient food resources for a woman to use, for a young girl, for example, to use for growing and maturing and laying down body fat and then for conceiving, carrying a pregnancy to term, and that sort of thing. But they're usually, even though I think resources, the evidence is that resources were adequate, I don't think there was ever, at least on a long-term basis, an abundance of resources, or what we would today recognize as an overabundance. There were probably times when there was more food available and girls could develop a little more fast and they could put on body fat that could be used for reproduction and so on. And those, say, due to seasonality, that would signal to the young girl's body that maybe now is a time that you can conceive. Obviously, there's no actual signal in that direct kind of communication sense, but the body would perceive that it was perhaps time to go ahead and ovulate, and if things work out right, to conceive and then carry a pregnancy to term. Those signals were probably very useful in the past, because during the lean times, the signal may have been that this is not a good time to try to become pregnant and to try to take care of biologically take care of a baby. But today, that same signal is a constant signal for most of us. We have so much available food resources that our body is kind of always receiving signals that we've got enough
go for
energy.
It.
Exactly. Go for it. Now's the time. It's a good time. And in fact, probably go for it is a pretty good idea of the way this might have happened, because, again, with shifting seasonality, and maybe some years were good and some years were not so good, as soon as the signal comes that, wow, I'm putting on body fat, that's basically I've put in my body has done the growing, it's done the fighting off of infections, and now I'm able to store some body fat. So, wow, this is the time to go for it. That kind of signal probably worked in many cases in the past. But today we're sort of getting that signal all the time. And one of the results of that, if you look at over the life course, is that girls are reaching puberty earlier and earlier. And in fact, we actually have medical records that have been kept in several countries for the last couple hundred years that show a quite dramatic decrease in the age of puberty. From about 15 or 16 years being kind of the normal age of puberty down to around 12 today in a country like the United States. And that dramatic decrease in onset of puberty, we think, is probably associated with lifestyle changes, which includes better health, which is a good thing about our modern environments, better health, so we're exposed to fewer pathogens and so on, but also more resources. And we're not as active as our ancestors were. Now, I'm speaking, of course, collectively, and certainly there are plenty of women marathon runners that are as active in many ways as our ancestors may have been.
My guest is Wenda Trevathan. She's professor emerita of anthropology at New Mexico State University and author of the 2010 book Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives: How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. She's in town to deliver the Termini Distinguished Anthropologist Lecture at UT Arlington this evening at 7. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Wenda Trevathan, Professor Emerita of Anthropology at New Mexico State University and author of Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. She's in town to deliver the annual Termini Distinguished Anthropologist Lecture at UTA this evening. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So we talked about earlier menarche. There's also the issue of menopause, which in this culture is something that women sort of dread, and they go through it and they get through it. I was really interested to read that there are places in the world where people don't even pay much attention to this.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of that has to do with reproductive history. For example, where birth control is not, at least the forms that we're familiar with, is not used, women tend to have babies about every 3 or 4 years. And they may have their last baby when they're about 45. They tend to nurse for 2 or 3 years after that. So if a woman has a baby when she's 45 and she nurses for 2 or 3 years, she basically never resumes her menstrual cycle and doesn't even pay much attention to that. But even where they do cycle for a few years and then terminate, which basically menopause is defined as 1 year since, it's defined retroactively by 1 year since the last menstruation. So it's based on menstruation that the definition comes. But even in those areas, doesn't appear to be as much of a problem. Now, people have begun asking much more specific questions of people. In other words, instead of saying, do women in your society experience problems with menopause? Do they experience hot flashes? Do they experience sleeplessness and so on? They've actually begun to ask more specific things. And a little bit more is coming up. But I think one of the problems, and I'm this is really a bit speculative, but one of the problems that I've encountered is that we tend to devalue aging in this society, and I say that very generally. I realize there are huge exceptions to that. But in a lot of societies, the older a woman becomes, the more valued she is in some ways for her knowledge, for her guidance, for her mentoring, in some cases for her healing abilities and things like that. So that ceasing to menstruate doesn't necessarily come with it a lowered status, but actually with a higher status. So in some cases, it's actually welcomed. Sometimes in our society, women welcome it because it means the end of menstrual cycling, especially if the cycles have been somewhat uncomfortable for them. But one of the things that is generally true, if you look at the sort of history of our understanding about menstrual cycling, is that menstrual cycling was actually very rare in the past. So it's that in itself, the idea of 13 menstrual cycles a year is something that's also very new because in the past, women, most of their reproductive lives at least, were spent while they were pregnant or nursing a child. And without birth control or abstinence, pretty soon after they started cycling again, they probably would get pregnant and start that particular cycle. So menstrual cycling was not the dominant theme of a woman's reproductive life in the past and in many cultures today, but it is a dominant theme of our society. Most of us think of the normal state or the most common state for a woman between ages, say, 15 and 50 is menstrual cycling. So when it stops, of course, it's a big deal. It's a big mark, a big transition. So there are lots of reasons why it may be more noticeable and maybe even more problematic in our society than it is in a lot of other parts of the world.
So everybody who went to high school knows that at the heart of evolution is reproductive advantage. And the question is always asked about, well, what would be, I hate to even say this as we sit here as two women, but what would be the value of a woman after she's no longer capable of reproducing children? But it turns out there's a significant value to a lot of people around a woman who is sort of freed from the responsibilities of caring for her own children.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, if you, again, looking at it cross-culturally, where women lead very active, busy working lives, and I mean working in the fields and gathering foods and that sort of thing, women become even more productive when they have stopped having children because they are, as you implied, freed from those kinds of obligations. And the most common thing for a woman to do is to be around kin, around her daughters or her daughters-in-law and their children. In other words, around her own grandchildren and to some extent great-grandchildren. And so providing food to share, and sharing is a characteristic that we find across all human societies, providing food that we share with our grandchildren happens in these cases. And in most cases that have been studied, women who have who provide more food for their offspring have more surviving offspring. So there appears to be, if I can use the language of evolution, a selective advantage to having older grandmothers around, and particularly older women who are in good health themselves.
We have an email here from Mary in Dallas who wants to know if there have been changes in the rates of reproductive cancers and infertility from our ancestors until now.
Definitely, and there are a couple reasons for that. One is that we are living longer, and many of those cancers come to women in their 70s and 80s. I think there's a common myth that women didn't live beyond 50, and therefore that's why men reproductive years ended around 50, because they were all dead by then. Well, that's not true. We know that once women reached, say, 10 or 15 years of age, their life expectancy was quite a bit higher than 50. Infant mortality was high, so life expectancy was low at birth. But once you got through those early years that were kind of risky, then your life expectancy extended. People are living longer lives. And so that's one reason why we have these reproductive cancers more commonly. But I think we absolutely do. If you look at the epidemiological data, you're going to find much, much higher rates of, for example, endometrial, ovarian, and uterine cancer in societies that are, again, for want of a better word, industrialized societies, societies like our own. I mean, the statistics are really quite stark. Even if you age control, you control for age in those, the statistics are quite stark. And it tends to be associated with low numbers of offspring, low numbers of years of breastfeeding children. In other words, it tends to be associated with highly frequent menstrual cycling, which, again, we think is a novel environment for the human body, for a woman's body today. Highly frequent menstrual cycling, 13 times a year, that means 13 times where you have cell turnover rates in the breast, in the endometrium, and the ovaries. And every time you get cell turnover, you expose cells to the opportunity to mutate in a way that can lead to cancers. So we think that the absolute number of menstrual cycles is probably highly correlated with the cancer rates that we see, and also probably the levels of estrogen and progesterone that we have today, which are much, much higher in, again, Western women, industrialized women, than they are in most other women in most other parts of the world, or we think in the past.
So I guess that complicates the issue of whether there would be a protective effect from, say, birth control methods that reduce the frequency of menstrual cycle, because you're introducing hormones.
Exactly. Well, it's we talk about decreasing the risk of heart attack and high blood pressure and things like that by altering lifestyle, and we tend to think that might be a better way of going about it rather than through surgical and pharmacological intervention. In certain cases, of course, surgical and pharmacological intervention are what you want. So if we're talking about interrupting menstrual cycling, reducing the number, say, to only 3 a year, that's equivalent to using pharmacological methods to try to deal with some of the diseases like atherosclerosis and so on. So I think that's one way to look at it, but it certainly doesn't mean that we are taking our bodies back to the ancestral pattern or anything like that. So it's obviously one of those individual choice things. We're using birth control pills, we're using oral contraceptives, and these menstrual suppressing oral contraceptives probably aren't terribly different from that, but it is not mimicking the ancestral pattern. So that's one thing people need to keep in mind.
So we made this big evolutionary trade-off when we started walking upright. That was good for us in a variety of ways. It allowed us to sort of see the world from a different perspective and use our hands in a different way. It has become harder for women than for other primates, to give birth. Talk about why that lasted, given the apparent risk to both mother and child of labor and delivery.
Based on evidence, based on our observations of, for example, monkeys and chimpanzees and some of our closest relatives, it does appear that childbirth is more complicated for humans. Now, I think to some extent we've made it more complicated in some cases with the technological interventions that we use.
Yeah.
and with the fact that when women give birth today, at least in our society, that's often the first birth they ever have any experience with. Mm-hmm. So it's uncertainty and the anxiety associated with that. So I think there are some lots of reasons that we could say that birth is more complicated today. But if you look at the behaviors of monkeys and chimpanzees when they're giving birth, they certainly do experience what we appear to be pain, what appears to be pain with the contractions. But the delivery of the infant doesn't seem to be as complicated. And again, I recognize that we are the ones that are perceiving it, and if we could interview them, we might have a different story. But it looks like it's much more complicated, and one reason has to do with that bipedal pelvis, which is a very different kind of pelvis from the four-legged animals like chimpanzees and monkeys. And what that means, because our infants are big, we actually give birth to very large infants, particularly large-headed infants, even though only about a quarter of our brain is developed at the time of birth. So relative to our brain size as adults, it's quite small, but we do give birth to large babies. And the best pelvis for bipedalism tends to be a fairly narrow pelvis. So we've got these two conflicting kinds of things, big-headed babies and small, relatively small pelvis that have to come together at the time of birth. And the dimensions of the baby and the birth canal are very, very close, so that the baby has to follow a series of rotations. The birth canal itself is rotated in adaptation to bipedalism, and the baby itself has to rotate as it comes through. Perhaps the most striking difference is that for most monkeys, for example, and chimpanzees, the baby comes out facing the same direction as the mother. And in order to imagine this, you have to think of a woman in an upright position. If you mm-hmm. think of her lying flat on her back, which is what we often think of when we think about giving birth, that's not going to work very well. But if you think of her standing up, a monkey baby will deliver her baby so the baby comes out facing in the same direction. She reaches down and guides the baby out of the birth canal. Many of these monkeys give birth in trees, so you can imagine if she didn't reach down, she would lose that baby probably. She guides it out, brings it up to her chest, and begins grooming it, licking it, and so on. The human, in a huge percentage of births, well over 95% of births, the baby comes out facing backwards, facing the other way. Now, women have given birth unattended throughout history. They continue to give birth unattended today. But given that she's probably having a little bit of stress and associated with standing there, even with support of her partner or some of the women there, the baby's coming out facing away from her. It's difficult, not impossible, but difficult for her to reach down and guide that baby up in the same way that the monkey can do. She's got a couple of challenges. Her physical position is challenging. If she pulls the baby back too hard as she guides it out, she could damage the nerves in its neck. The babies are often born with the cord around their necks, and she would have difficulty moving the cord over the neck so that the baby could emerge. And sometimes they're covered in fluid such a way that they can't breathe. So anything she can do to help that baby as it's born would be advantageous, but it's complicated because she's baby's born facing the other way. What I have argued in my research on birth is that the anxiety associated with birth, and I mean sort of average anxiety, mm-hmm. I don't mean sheer terror, but the anxiety associated with birth led the normally gregarious human female to turn to her, probably her sisters and her co-wives, her mother, and so on, at the time of labor and delivery. And those people, just by being there to alleviate her emotional stresses, were there to help guide the baby out. And so I've argued that the anxiety that a woman feels at birth has adaptive value in that it leads her to seek assistance at birth, and having a companionship at birth probably enhanced the survival of both mothers and babies in the past. And so we have today, as an evolutionary legacy, anxiety mm-hmm. at the time of birth. And I have argued that unless it gets extreme, which it does in some cases, unless it gets extreme, having companionships like doulas, which have become a very, very popular profession, if you will, having a doula or some other form of social support at the time of labor and delivery is a lot better for most women than the drugs that we often turn to.
You mentioned that most of us, when we think of a woman laboring to give birth, we think of her flat on her back, feet in stirrups. This is maybe not the ideal position to labor in.
Well, it's actually probably the worst position, unless you're talking about standing on your head or something like that, which would be interesting. The best position is probably squatting, because that spreads open the birth canal a little bit. It's not a position most of us in our society can assume.
Because we sit in chairs.
Exactly. We sit in chairs. We even sit to go to the bathroom. So we don't have that experience supporting our weight, particularly through contractions and things like that and through the pushing movements. So it's not an easy position for us to obtain, but somehow being as upright as possible, because then you have the force of gravity mm-hmm. working with you. And there are all kinds of advantages to the upright position if a woman can do that with her own strength, or if she can do it with support, or end up with the birthing chairs that are now putting women in an upright position. So the flat on the back is great, I guess, for the obstetrician or the midwife, but it's not the best for the mother and the baby.
Is that really why it has socially evolved? It's the most comfortable position for the people in the room.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, try to imagine yourself as a midwife trying to guide out a baby on a woman that's squatting, and she may just be, 12 or 15 inches off the floor, and you're having to crawl around down there on the floor to try to help guide it out. Mm-hmm. It is. I think that's probably why it first evolved.
So we all know at this point, or most people know, the value of breastfeeding for the developing infant. It turns out it's really good for a postpartum mother as well.
There are lots of reasons for that. In fact, you could spend a long time just cataloging the advantages to the mother and the advantages, of course, to the infant. I think, as you point out, very obvious. One advantage is a reduction in reduced breast cancer. Now, I'm talking about epidemiological. I'm talking about population. So you can't necessarily say this woman
is your guarantee.
Will not get breast cancer because she's breastfeeding. But at least statistically, it seems to be associated with a lower. The longer you breastfeed, the lower your risk of these reproductive cancers of endometrial, ovarian, and breast cancer. So there are advantages to that. There are advantages to regaining your body weight if that's something that a woman wants to do, is go back to her pre-pregnancy weight. It occurs a lot faster. And it's actually, I've not had children, so I can't be an authority on this. But it's actually for women who don't have to deal with the stresses of breastfeeding, which can be quite severe bleeding from the nipple, bleeding, a lot of pain and that kind of stuff. But for women who want to breastfeed, who are assisted in that process and who are comfortable doing it, it's a very pleasurable kind of thing, people have reported. So there are lots of good things that come from breastfeeding for women. Mothers.
My guest is Wenda Trevathan. She's professor emerita of anthropology at New Mexico State University and author of the 2010 book Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. She's in town to lecture this evening at UTA. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Wenda Trevathan, professor emerita of anthropology at New Mexico State University and author of Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. She's in town to deliver the annual Termini Distinguished Anthropologist Lecture at UT Arlington. That takes place tonight at 7 o'clock. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Carrie in Frisco. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, thank you for your show, and thank you for having me. I'd just like to comment on the different positions that women like to use for labor and delivery. I'm a mother of five, and I'm also a 26-year labor and delivery nurse. And I just wanted to point out that watching a lot of women go through natural labor, believe it or not, it can be very natural for them when they get close to the delivery portion of their process that they want to lay down. It's not always for the convenience of the physician or the nurses. A lot of times it's a position of comfort for the laboring woman. Also, when you look at the different angles of how a woman is sitting up or laying down pushing, in my 20 years of experience, women have a lot more success pushing their babies out when they're in more of a reclining position.
Well, I'm really glad you called with that perspective. Thank you so much for that, Carrie.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent corrective, and thank you for offering that. I worked as a midwife for a year and occasionally returning for a month or so at a time at a birth center in El Paso. And we basically had the women do whatever they wanted to. This was a lay midwife home birth clinic or facility. And they could be in any position they wanted to. And they usually labored walking or squatting, sitting, not squatting. But when it came time for delivery, just as she pointed out, they preferred to actually be reclining. Now, not flat on the back. I think the mistake I made was not emphasizing that what I was talking about was the flat of the back stirrups position, which is the way you initiated that question. But reclining, kind of so they could sort of see what was going on, leaning back on pillows and that kind of thing. So you're absolutely right that is often the most comfortable position for a woman, particularly when it is in terms of muscles and everything like that, is a very there's a lot of exertion that goes on at birth. So thank you for making that correction.
So there's a lot of debate these days over the rising rate of cesarean deliveries to vaginal births. And one thing that I think is interesting is, asking, would most women who now deliver by cesarean have been unable to deliver their children historically?
Well, I guess it depends on the reason for the cesarean. Mm-hmm. If it's cephalopelvic dysproportion, the baby's head is just too big to get through, then you could have an impaction occurring that would have probably killed the mother and the baby or killed one and maybe left the other okay. So if the reason is that kind of thing that they're delivering, then those babies probably wouldn't have been born in the past. If the reason is, say, a previous cesarean, but there's no particular reason to suspect that this baby needs to be delivered by cesarean, then it's possible that women today would have no trouble giving birth at that time. A lot of times, of course, women choose cesareans because they think it's better or it's a little more convenient or there's less pain involved or less stress or they can schedule it and so on. So those women probably could have given birth in the past without a cesarean section if they hadn't had that option. So I think the short answer is simply that it depends on what the reason for the cesarean is. And it appears in some parts of the world, at least in some medical facilities in the world, that the rate of cesarean section is increasing quite dramatically over the last couple of decades. And I suspect that a lot of times a lot of that increase is due to elective cesarean sections, where women are choosing that, women and their clinicians are choosing that rather than medically necessary.
I'm not a scientist. I take no position on this question. But I was interested in the apparent benefits to the fetus of passing through the birth canal that I hadn't been aware of before.
It looks like there are some good things about that. I mean, we think about all the squishing and pressures.
Sounds awful.
It sounds terrible in fact, they sometimes come out looking pretty awful with the head molding and not bruises, but a bluing of the body and so on. So it looks like it's probably pretty stressful. But closer inspection tells us that might be really good for getting the lungs, getting some fluids out of the lungs, and just that kind of whole pressure squeezing, manipulating of the body that seems to be associated with better respiration immediately after birth, better elimination in the few hours after birth, and so on. So there may be some good developmental things that happen as a result of that squeezing.
How culturally does our modern society discourage women from breastfeeding as long as they might otherwise do? And we don't want to, I suppose there are some social pressures, but there are just things that make it more difficult for a lot of women to go certainly 3 years that are great-great-grandmothers 1,000 years back would have done.
Right. Well, I think 3 years would be unusual by American standards. Would not be that unusual by world standards. It looks like somewhere between 2 and 3 years are what we find if we look at it across all populations. 2 or 3 years is the sort of median time of breastfeeding. But I would say it's very difficult. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends exclusive breastfeeding for the first 6 months and then continue breastfeeding with supplementation for the next 12 to 18 months. So they're recommending something that is a little bit more consonant with what we think our ancestors were doing, a little closer to that, based on presumably pretty good research that they've done. But it's really difficult for women to do because most women today are working or they're taking care of more children. There are all kinds of things that are competing for their attention and their time. And it seems sometimes that the easiest thing to do would be to cease breastfeeding, even for women who intend to breastfeed for a longer time, and let their husbands help out, let their girlfriends help out, let the nanny help out, or whomever is available to help with childcare, because they can all give the bottle. So work demands are one of the reasons for that. Challenges in nursing in public, as you say, the social stuff is pretty obvious as well. So I think women simply don't get enough support in most cases for the kinds of breastfeeding length and duration that may be optimal for their baby's health and maybe what they wanted, but they really find it difficult and challenging in modern society to do that.
You and I were discussing this in the break, and if it's not apparent to people listening to the conversation, this book is not about suggesting that we all sort of go back and live in very primitive ways without benefit of modern society or technology. But can you talk about some of the ways that this kind of study can inform the choices we make, even the understanding we have about the problems that arise in our lives physically?
Well, you're right. We can't all go back to being hunters and gatherers. First of all, there's 7 billion of us around, and if we tried to do that, we would outcompete so violently that most of us wouldn't survive. So we can't go back to that, and we wouldn't want to. Good gosh, there's some fantastic things about modern life that we would never trade. Listening to the radio is certainly one of them. And modern health, the options that we have in terms of health, the options period that we have in our lives, we probably wouldn't change that. But I think there's some things that the research I've done and anybody who reads the book would probably get some ideas that they could use for themselves in making some decisions. And certainly a lot of them are the same thing we hear every day, day in, day out, and that is modifying our diet to be more consistent with what our bodies evolved for, because we probably didn't evolve to have a huge percentage of our calories coming from fat and from simple sugars and those kinds of things. So that probably the dietary changes that we've seen recently, say in the last 100 years, probably account for a lot of the health challenges we have. And that's nothing. There's nothing new about that. So modifying our diet, particularly by reducing fats and simple carbohydrates and so on, I think probably not the easiest thing for most of us, but certainly one logical thing is to increase our activity levels. Mm-hmm. We can never match what our ancestors were doing. They were walking miles every day.
Yeah, what was the sort of Paleolithic workout like?
It was steady, pretty mm-hmm. much throughout the day. It wasn't every single day by any means. There were plenty of days when they had plenty of food and they could sit around and talk and gossip and make music and recite poetry and those sorts of things. There were all kinds of things going on. But a typical woman, for example, would walk many, many miles, usually in search of food with her sisters, with other women, usually women walking together and the toddlers and the babies. And they were often pregnant, carrying a 2 or 3 year old who would not be able to keep up that pace, taking care of a 6 year old, and carrying food, carrying big amounts of water, large amounts of water, and those kinds of things. So they were working pretty hard. Even for those of us who run every single day for 30 minutes, which I try to do, we're not coming close to what they were doing. But obviously, that's better than constantly sitting at your desk mm-hmm. all day long. So increasing activity levels is certainly one very important thing. And I think when you think about lifelong health, increasing activity levels in young girls is probably the one thing we could do to improve their health and reduce their chances of some of these late-life cancers and things like that, because that seems to be associated. Athletics in young children and continuing athletics, and I don't necessarily mean team sports, because there are some young girls that just don't want to do team sports, but being outdoors, being busy, staying away from all the technology that we have for a couple hours a day or something like that. walking, running, hiking, all those kinds of things. If young girls could do that right on through their teen years, from early years on up, and continue that into, because there's evidence that people who start being active early in life are more likely to continue that. So those kinds of things would probably help, probably would reduce the, might even increase the age of puberty. It might drive it up a little bit. Again, one person is not a sample, but looking at it statistically. And probably would reduce the overall levels of reproductive hormones that we have as young women and women of reproductive ages. We have high levels of estrogen and progesterone, and being very active physically probably would help that. So those are two things that would probably help, but they're the same things that we hear over and over about our health in general, so there's nothing new there, but it still seems to be very important.
It makes perfect sense to separate out work like this according to sex, and you happen to focus on women here. I'm wondering, though, are women bodies more complicated from an evolutionary perspective than men's bodies?
Well, they're more vulnerable to particularly energy availability. If there's not a whole lot of energy, not a lot of calories available, men, it has to be pretty severe before sperm production is interfered with, again, on the population level. It has to be pretty bad. Men, until they really reach the verge of really severe starvation, are probably still going to be able to be reproductively viable. For women, it may not be very much. Now, that's going to be dependent on the woman's body, because if she is... has been pretty sitting around and watching TV or reading or whatever else, has not been very active for a long period of time. Say she's 30 years old and she decides she's going to take an exercise plans. She starts getting preparing for a marathon or something like that. Her body will probably react very quickly to that and actually may even cease ovulating. Mm-hmm. If she's been active all her life and been working out all her life and she decides to begin to train for a marathon, it may not affect that. Marathon is pretty extreme for most women. But our bodies it appears that women's bodies are a little bit more vulnerable to some of these changes. So that even a slight decrease in energy availability may alter reproductive functioning, reproductive capacity through the hormones and things like that. That happens when we become sick, for example. That might be interfered with increasing activity levels. Extreme dieting. Mm-hmm. A lot of us think that that's the way to lose body weight, but that sends a signal to the body that, whoa, this
Something's
is not a good
wrong.
Time to have a baby. So a lot of women who are not able to conceive, for example, who are trying to figure out ways of increasing their likelihood of conceiving, may find that severe body restriction of food intake is not the way to go. But that, of course, would have to be something that would work out with talking to your advisor, health advisor, or something like that.
It really is amazing the way our bodies work and how well we know the million ways they can go wrong, but how well they typically serve us.
I
just can't stop thinking about that sometimes.
Exactly. Of course, that's not true for everybody. There are plenty of people that their bodies haven't served them well. But it is. I mean, in doing the research for this book, trying to think of all the things that can go wrong in a pregnancy, for example, it's amazing that any of us are here and that any of us have reached, in a reasonably good state of health, reached our late years of life and can live so long in such healthy situations. So I think, obviously, one of the keys to our success is that we are highly plastic, if you will. We're highly adaptable. So we can, obviously, there are problems if we immediately go into a vegetarian diet, for example, or immediately go into an all-meat diet. But our bodies can respond to that within certain limitations.
Wenda Trevathan is Professor Emerita of Anthropology at New Mexico State University and author of the 2010 book Ancient Bodies, Modern Lives, How Evolution Has Shaped Women's Health. She will deliver the annual Termini Distinguished Anthropologist Lecture at UT Arlington this evening. Wenda, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn about the show and download the podcast at KERA.org/think. Follow me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and email your comments and questions to think@KERA.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.